Stay hungry, stay foolish.
So it's a great pleasure to invite Mike Feinberg, co-founder of KIP, Knowledge is Power Program, to the show. Mike, you're very welcome.
Aidan, thank you so much for having me on across the sea. It's great to talk to you.
It's a great pleasure because I read about you first in Paul Tough's book, How Children Succeed. And what I was doing as a father, but also as a coach, was to understand elements of how people develop grit and the work you've done to unlock that advantage that people have where they come from places of adversity is really admirable. And I just wanted to talk to you about how you managed to innovate in a very, very traditional environment of education.
Sure. Happy to engage. KIP, the Knowledge is Power Program, was started back in 1994 by Dave Levin and myself. We were two Teach for America teachers. I know, you know, Teach for America is now part of Teach for All. I know there's Teach First in England. I don't know if it's where you are as well, but it's a program that recruits recent college graduates that are not education majors to go into teaching for at least 2 years before they embark on their career in law, business, medicine, engineering, and just use their skills to contribute to what's going on in especially underserved communities in those schools. And so Dave Levin and I were these two Teach America teachers back in 1992 that were placed in Houston, Texas, in two impoverished schools. I was on the north side, Dave was on the south side. We were both upper elementary teachers. And we got very frustrated quickly in that it seemed like it didn't matter how good of a job we were doing with our children. That was the last year of primary school before they went up to secondary school. And when our former kids went to secondary school, we realized that they were still, no matter how good of a job they were doing with us in our classroom, they were going off to middle secondary schools and they were joining gangs and doing drugs and skipping class and becoming just as many parents as the typical statistics in those schools and neighborhoods. It was very frustrating. And in the fall of 1993, we actually quit finger pointing at others and looked in the mirror and pointed at ourselves and said that we had the kids for a whole year as teachers. And we could honestly say we gave them all the academic skills, all the intellectual habits, all the character qualities they would need to go off and forget just doing well in sixth grade or passing the next test, but were we really propelling them to have a transformative education to do well in middle school, high school, universities, and beyond, and have a great life? And the answer was we weren't even close to doing that. So we sat down at the computer all night long, turned on you'll love this one given your country. We turned on U2, Octung Baby, repeat play. And we had that play until about 5 o'clock in the morning when we had the Knowledge is Power program on our computer screen. And the premise of KIP back then in late 1993, it is 23 years later, is simply there are no shortcuts. That we're going to try to provide children with all these academic, intellectual, and character skills. Quit looking for the magic bullet, the magic computer software program, the magic teacher training module. Let's just roll up our sleeves as teachers and get after it. And so we motivated kids to come to school from 7:30 to 5 during the week for 4 hours every other Saturday for an extra month in the summer. And we would give them 2 hours of homework every night, all in the name of getting a great education and getting ahead. It worked well, but it was 1 year. We still didn't have any good middle schools, secondary schools to send our kids to. So in 1995, we convinced the Houston School District to let us do this. Dave Levin's from New York City. We also convinced the New York City School District to let us do it there too. And so in 1995, KIP became these two schools within schools in Houston, New York, fifth grade through eighth grade, as choice public schools in underserved communities. And then in 2000, after these two schools were doing very well and news programs like 60 Minutes were coming out doing pieces on our kids because we were performing at, our kids were at the top levels in Houston, New York. We partnered up with Don and Doris Fisher, the founders of The Gap and Old Navy clothing stores, to figure out how to replicate this good work in other places. And we did that by recruiting other great teachers and training them for a whole year how to plan, open, and run their own KIPP school and basically teach them how to be principals, how to be school leaders. And they would found their own schools mainly through the charter school law across the United States. And today, that's how there's now 200 of these KIPP public schools in 20 states in D.C. with 80,000 kids. And the results so far are, we look at all of our eighth graders, wherever they go to high school, whether they stay with us or go elsewhere, over half of them have graduated from universities. And compared that with 8% of low-income kids in the U.S. who graduate from universities, we're 6X, and we celebrate that value add. But our goal is 80%, which is what top quartile income kids in the United States go to and through the universities at that rate. So we're proud of the work we've done thus far, and we have a lot more work to do.
That's phenomenal. It's just phenomenal work. And it just shows you that a couple of guys can just make that big of a difference in something that seems like just a massive, massive task. And it was that mindset that I really wanted to talk to you about, that, you know, you overcame, I'm sure, so many huge obstacles, and, you know, you're fighting the tide all the time, because, you know, within a company, if you're in any company, people tend to accept the excuses. The, you know, like you did, you said, okay, well, what am I doing about it? And you looked in the mirror. And I'd love to know about that. Like, how did you keep yourself motivated? How did you get others on board?
Yeah, it's a great question. You're right. I mean, in any large bureaucracy, innovation's not encouraged. You're supposed to kind of keep your head down and go with the flow. And I think what motivated us back then to try something different, and what's motivated us every day ever since, are the children. The fact that we're creating these opportunities for kids to come to school longer every day and make sure they're getting their homework done and having a longer year. It's not skill and drill. We're not just passing out worksheets for 10 hours a day. We're doing our best to make learning fun, but our kids could be choosing other schools with less hours and less days, and yet they're showing up every day eager to learn and learn what they need to do, not to pass a test, but to have a great life. And if they're willing to make that choice, then that's been the motivation for us, the adults, to deliver on what they're searching for.
Yeah, and when I say, I mean, the obstacles, I mean, for somebody listening to the show will think, oh, he means, you know, the obstacles of the system. But when I read deep into KIPP and some of the work you've done, it's the kids themselves at home. They a lot of these kids, they're not expected to succeed. And in fact, there's probably a little bit of trying to, you know, the tall poppy syndrome, where you're not good enough to be getting out of here. None of us are. And trying to drag the kid down. And how you overcame all that as well. And I know that's where you built your network and your alliances to make that happen. But any kind of nuggets on that, Mike?
Yeah. You know, every kid wants to belong to something. They want to be part of a group. They want to be part of a, call it a gang. You know, I mean, the question, are they going to have options to join a positive gang, or is it going to be a negative gang? And too often on the streets, there's plenty of opportunities to join negative gangs. What we did was we created a not just a school, but a culture of team and family where kids truly felt like they belonged. And there was a sense of they had their family at home, and then they had their family at school. And they knew that we considered ourselves a team and a family, and we looked out for one another, and we solved problems together, and we lifted each other up. And I think just creating that kind of you know, every school and every community is a natural hub to create that kind of culture. Unfortunately, too often, the people that go through education training to learn how to lead schools. They might learn good education pedagogy, but they don't learn how to create these type of supportive, nurturing cultures that sustain over time. And I think that's what we've trained our teachers on how to do, to create these places where kids want to belong.
It's so reflective, Mike, of corporate innovation, where, you know, you'll start off and you know, I call them nerd clubs or watering holes, where you get the lion and the zebra to drink peacefully together and create, you know, from different silos within companies. Yeah. And you create a bit of positive momentum. And then where other people start looking in and kind of going, I want to be part of that. And yeah. I suppose, I don't know if you've seen this, but is what happened for you where the people who aren't part of that either complain and go back to their corner, or, you know, how do you get those guys on board? Because I know you're not going to win everybody, but what tricks have you learned, or techniques to try and get people to be more attracted to that group?
We'll talk about the techniques in a minute, but I think you put your finger on what I can still consider to be one of the two biggest challenges we face in all of this. To me, the biggest challenge remains teaching children any given day, any given subject, any given hour, because trying to teach is an easy thing. Trying to teach well is a very difficult thing. It's like being a parent. It's easy to be a parent. It's hard to be a great parent. And teaching is both an art and a science. That remains the hardest thing there is. Second to that, what I found is like, this is like the headwinds to me are the beliefs and mindsets across the United States, which I've learned through Teach for All are prevalent. It's not just a United States challenge. It's a worldwide global challenge where society collectively does not yet believe that children growing up in low-income communities can succeed in school and can succeed in life, as well as children from more affluent communities. And until we attack that belief and mindset, it's going to be hard for us to wrap our head around what we do across the entire system, the entire country, to improve. Because hard for our leaders to have the political will and determination if we don't collectively believe a different outcome is possible. And again, you know, I don't know what the Ireland stats are, but I imagine they're probably not that terribly different from the United States, where, depending on the time and place of your birth, if you are born into a family that's in the top quartile income, you have an 80% chance of going to and through college, the universities. And if you are born into a bottom quartile income family, you have an 8% chance.
Yeah.
You know, that's what, and too many people believe that's just the way it is. And one thing I always the mindset that what I use to kind of illustrate this point is I ask people, imagine where you guys are too, across the ocean. Picture two secondary schools, two in Ireland, wherever people are listening. Take one school that's an elite university prep school, public, private, doesn't matter. Then take a typical large comprehensive secondary school serving a low-income community. Picture both these schools in our heads. Start with the elite university prep school. A kid there is going to graduate and go to universities. Is that amazing? No, they all do. Now imagine a kid there drops out of school. Oh my goodness. Yeah. You know, the moms are whispering in carpool pickup line, right? Now transfer go to the other school in a low-income community. A kid there drops out of school. So yeah, well, have to. More than half of some of our schools, right? A kid there graduates, does well, goes to universities, does well in the universities, goes out in the world, does well in the world. You know, Aiden, we still make a TV movie the week about that kid.
Yeah.
So that just shows the societal level, we still hold different beliefs, expectations on our children, depending on the time and place of their birth. And that's what we have. That's, I think, been the biggest challenge for us to overcome. And even like when Kip did this early on in the 90s, people would make these yes buts. I call these excuses. They'd say, yeah, fine. Well, Kip works, but it's because you're doing it. You're finding like the handful of kids in that low income community who care, and the rest of the kids and families don't care or are not, you know, don't have the skills to learn. And So one reason why we've grown around the U.S. is just like wherever people are making these excuses saying, well, it can work in this community but can't work in that community, we want to start schools there and prove the possible. Because the day the excuses end or the day the solutions are going to start. And that's what we've been doing across the U.S. thus far. And now starting to do it across the world too.
That's fantastic because, it's reflective of any kind of innovation program that you will only get so far until you get top level buy-in from your CEO or senior managers, and in your world that's coming from top politicians, you know, presidential status, that until that those guys, you know, make change, you know, right. You're only going to get so far. You cannot win. That's one of the things I thought was so reflective, Mike, of your work and the success you've had despite that. Because in any industry or business, without senior management support, you know, you're only going to get so far. But I never thought about that, your point about our own perceptions that are, you know, it's like a bias that we all have. We just expect it because that's the world as we know it today. And that's accepted that's the way it is.
Yeah, exactly. That's what, you know, I like when I'm talking on the stump, I'll read Dr. Seuss on Beyond Zebra and talks about like the alphabet beyond Z. And I make the point that there's other, we keep faces, you know, one time we thought the world was flat, right? Until people realized it wasn't. And just 100 years ago, we thought smoking was okay for you. In fact, we thought smoking helped athletic performance. And now we know about tobacco better. I mean, so like, we have to make sure we have to challenge ourselves to not just think like the gospel that we believe today is the way it is. And there's like there's only 20% of the population that's really university ready, and the rest of the rest of the kids better go figure out some day labor type job. Which, by the way, those type of careers are disappearing anyway as technology improves. So we have to do more. One thing I will go back to what you said is you're right. We do need support from politicians and our community leaders. But there's a trap in that we need their support, but we don't want them to come up with the top-down solution. Because that's where we get in trouble is when we expect the education minister to come up with the one solution that's going to work for all the millions of children in the school system. There's not, right? Our children are vastly different, so the way we deliver education has to be vastly different. We can't expect one size fits all for all the kids. So at the top, we need their support to allow bottom-up solutions to happen. And that's, I think, in the United States, these public charter schools that have started, the what I think they're called the free schools that started in UK, at least in England. These are examples of where NGOs are starting public schools with support of the government to start so that there's new ways to deliver education to communities. So it's not one size fits all has been so important.
There's a great cartoon you reminded me of where it shows like an elephant and a monkey and a cheetah all lined up and a teacher going jump through this hoop. And the hoop's tiny, and it's about the education system. It's going, that's what we're actually asking them to do. All these kids are different. They're different mentally. The background's different. The biases are different. Yet we want a one-size-fits-all education system to create drones. And the irony being the drones are going to replace those rote tasks that we're training people to fit in to do. Then, you know, you see self-driving cars. People can't drive a cab anymore. You know, and then there's more people in the world because of technology. So the work you're doing is almost cushioning us for that blow that's coming.
Yeah, I mean, we have to be as Wayne Gretzky taught us in the NHL. We have to skate where the puck is going, not where the puck is.
Yeah.
And the way we're delivering education, like the fact that there's government funded education as a concept, I think it's a noble concept, and we should all defend it. We should not let that go away, that the community is going to pool its resources to educate all of our children. That's crucial. But then there's the way we deliver education. And I know it's slightly different there in Ireland, but like in the United States, the way we deliver education for the last 100 years, over 100 years since the Industrial Revolution, is that we create these tax zones called school districts. And the school districts elect a board to govern the school district. And the board hires superintendent. The superintendent will hire these principals, these heads of schools, and the heads will run these schools, and we draw zones around the schools. And if you live in that zone, that school you go to, right? What I'm describing, that's not government-funded public education. That's how we've chosen to deliver it. And we shouldn't have so much hubris to believe in the last 100 years we've created God's gift to how you deliver education to all of our children, and there's no other way to do it. Charter schools, free schools are one more way to do it. And charter schools are not God's gift either. But the idea being, let's get out of the definition of insanity loop. If we know that we are going to that the world has changed, and that now most of our kids are going to have to go to some form of post-secondary school to have the training and the skills they need to have a career and a job in society in what today, and especially what's coming in the next few decades. What are we doing to deliver education differently to prepare our kids for that moving target? Because after all, the purpose of education is not to pass a government exam.
Absolutely. Right?
The purpose of education is, what can you do with your education when you're done with it?
The way education is going, it's not just about the hoop you need to jump through, which is get through the exam. It's what does it prepare you for life? What qualities, integrity, elasticity, all these kind of skills. And it's one of the things I found from reading about the work you've done with Kip, is that these kids have an unbelievably overlooked talent, which is grit, because if they can get through the system, these people make unbelievable entrepreneurs, business people, and workers, because they've overcome that.
Yep, and that's another mind exercise I do with people, because I'll tell people, Matt, like, everyone who's listening, who's an employer, who has to recruit and select people for an open position, there's lots of different ways we go about it. What I've never heard anyone do is tell their assistant to go through the stack of resumes and applications, research everyone's government exam score when they were in high school, and hire the top score sight unseen.
Yeah.
No, I mean, we definitely want intelligent people, articulate people working for us, but we also want people who are creative, who can solve problems, who've got that grit and the tenacity, who can follow directions, give directions, work on a team, who've got self-control. And to your point, like, the grit and self-control and optimism, those that none of us are born in this world knowing those things any more than we know algebra, right? So those things have to get taught. And we learn them from our parents and our families and our churches and our neighbors. And it makes sense we should also learn them where we're spending most of our waking hours as children, which is school. So that's how we're viewing that. So it's not either or. It's that academics and character are the yin and yang of what we both need to do to prepare kids for success in post-secondary school and life.
What you're doing is preparing the world and setting an example, and you're leading by example for the rest of the world to follow. And where can people find out more about KIPP if they'd like to end the one school?
Yeah, just go on the web to www.kipp.org. And there's also the One World Network of Schools. People can Google that. One World Network of Schools is the NGO we set up to help educators in other countries learn from what KIPP's doing in the U.S. so they can do similar work in their country.
Thank you for being a leader in this and for all the work you've done. And thank you for your time today. Mike Feinberg, co-founder of KIPP, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Aidan. Talk soon. Appreciate you.
Thanks, man.
Bye.
So now in the Innovation Show, we welcome Ollie Feagan, CEO and founder of UsherU and previously Tempster. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Aidan.
Good to have you here. Before we talk to about your current project with UsherU, you've kindly offered to talk about the backstory behind this with Tempster and the learnings you had from that. So let's jump straight into it. So how did you get to Tempster and then onto UsherU?
I suppose I was working in a family business which sold to the restaurant space, and I suppose the idea for Tempster was to help restaurants sell empty seats. So I suppose one day I was going in and out of restaurants, and they kept saying to me, I was looking for cash, basically, you owe me money this week. And I went in and said, do you have the money? And they said, look, business has been terrible. We have done nothing all week. And I just kept thinking, is if you could sell tables in real time and customers knew which restaurants were looking to get them in, there's a business there. So one day I just said, look, you know, I want to do my own thing. And I bit the bullet. I basically quit work. I had no background in technology. I had no, you know, partner at this stage to basically set it all up. And I just started basically, I suppose, building a roadmap of what I needed to do. And I got onto the New Frontiers program in Enterprise Ireland. Through there, I found a developer who had a friend who wasn't doing something. I got a little bit of funds to pull something together. And it just sort of started. And I suppose in terms of the key learnings, probably what I learned most is that you need a good team. Again, I started as a lone wolf. I managed to get out with a few great interns to get lots of restaurants on board. We had a basic product, but I had the roadmap to get the product onto the market, but not to innovate with the product. So I think really what I learned was, you know, you have to continually innovate. What you're doing this week needs to be improved next week. You need to know where you are, not just to launch, but how to basically build it into a sustainable business.
If you're in a restaurant business and you have that problem, sometimes you need to zoom in and actually take time to go, actually, there's a widespread problem here. And if you think about the data that even gives you of, you know, what days of the weeks are most profitable, what days of the weeks people go to a restaurant most often, there's a whole data play there as well.
Yeah. And I think I definitely didn't spot that when I was starting off. You know, that's the big part. I think the more that we know about habits, the more we can actually, I suppose, bring proper change, not just sort of one-offs, let's fill a table now. It's about the bigger change. It's about sort of optimizing businesses. And very much, I suppose, where when it came to the end of the road, which was the end of funding, and I suppose while we had a great, you know, user base, it was never going to be a sustainable business until we raised proper funds. And the space was getting crowded in. So OpenTable had just bought over players in the space. OpenTable was bought over by Booking.com's parent company. So what people saw was that they're trying to basically get into the restaurant space, and all the investors said, look, we're not going to invest. You can't go head to head against these guys. They've got too much funds. You need, you know, 20 million funding to succeed. So it was sort of, you know, I suppose with a heavy heart, I said, I think as a startup or a founder, you have to say is, look, I have to draw a line on this. I could have brought a little bit of a wage for myself, but I was never going to make a proper business out of it. So, yeah. You know, one day, I basically just pressed the off button, yeah. Which was tough, but, you know, you sort of move on.
Yeah, and you did, and you moved on very quickly. Because, I have to tip the cap to you, because you did that so quickly. You know, Tempster was there, all of a sudden, Usher U was there. And it was really, really quickly, and fair play to you.
And again, it's through a bit of luck. My brother, so I suppose, will I explain a little bit of what Usher U
does? Sure, yeah, please do, yeah.
It's essentially what we do is we learn about every consumer's preferences for cinema. So what types of films they look at, which cinemas they go to. Then basically they can buy tickets for all cinemas in three clicks through our product. So instead of putting your credit card details in to lots of different, you know, websites, and it can take up to 20 clicks to do it, we drop it to three clicks. And the biggest problem in the cinema industry is the stat is 92% of people who say they're going to go and see a film just forget. We say Ghostbusters is out next week. You see it on Graham Norton. You say you're going to go to the cinema next week, but you just kind of forget to go to see it. So what we do is when it's just about to leave the cinema, for example, we alert consumers that their local cinema is going to stop playing on Thursday. So if you're going to buy a ticket, now's the time. And I think kind of actually how we started it at the start was one of my good friends, Catherine Downs, who I went to university with, the two of us were talking about doing stuff at the same time. And my brother Alex is a filmmaker. And his biggest problem when he was making films was every single film project is a one-off project. So he's currently showing a film in the States at the moment, and his last film, The Irish Pub, played in the States as well. But when he was bringing it out to the States, the new film, it literally was a whole new marketing campaign. There was no overlap between one film to the next. So there's just a huge amount of data that's missing, which could really optimize it. And, you know, cinemas on one hand have 75% empty seats. Distributors now spend twice as much marketing films. And kind of talking to Alex and one of his friends who ran one of the cinemas in Dublin, we really saw that there was an opportunity to bring the data in to allow people to go to the cinema more, where they kind of just forget to go.
If you think about somebody like Netflix or Hulu or one of the players like that, they're monitoring the habits of people on their own platform all the time. And you've kind of zoomed up in the helicopter and went, okay, well, I'm going to do that for a network of different cinemas across the world and actually go, these guys, this cohort are guys who go to arts films. These guys are only interested in horror movies, the horror genre or scary movies, the odd action flick.
Yeah.
Which is where I fall with. And then you go, these are comedies, and these are obviously families. And then you kind of go, okay. And like Netflix, you have the only problem you have is, who is it, the kid or is it the parent using the account at the time? You know, that kind of
exactly.
way. So if you kind of mirror that in what you've done, it's brilliant. And the distribution pipeline becomes the cinema, parent cinema companies, rather than have to walk the streets like you would have done with Tempster. So it actually becomes a quicker, if you can get over the line with the cinemas, because I'm sure that's a big task.
Yeah, and I suppose, so the key thing for us is, and what we didn't do with Tempster is we integrate with the point of sale systems of the cinemas. So if someone buys a ticket through Usher U, we write a ride onto their system of the cinema. So there's no having to confirm if the seat's there, it's actually bought straight
in real time.
Cinema in real time.
Wow.
So that's, I suppose, another key learning was, you know, we needed to, I suppose we're a marketplace, so there's demand side and supply side. If we don't hack the supply side and sort that out, we can never get the demand. So these are the things we've done, I suppose, to make it much simpler, and also trying to actually make it simpler for the cinemas to come on board. We can say is, look, you have no work. You sign up with us. We sell a ticket. It gets written onto your system. The consumer comes with a QR code or a booking number, goes to the cinema kiosk, puts it in, and they get their ticket out. So we're trying, I suppose, to remove as many barriers to them coming on board. But it's a traditional industry. It's going through an awful lot of change. Netflix is changing, I suppose, the market. And when I started, before we actually started, I looked at Netflix and said, I think this is going to kill the cinema industry. But what we've really seen is, I suppose, if film is art, the cinema is the gallery. It's a place where you don't have your mobile phone out, checking your emails, checking Facebook. You're there uninterrupted to watch a beautiful film, which people have spent, you know, 5 years making.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful art form. And it really, I think that's where cinema has its part.
Yeah.
And kind of our part is to, you know, the cinema has to put on a great performance, good concessions, clean cinemas. Our job is to learn about what the consumers do and help them make bookings quickly.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, we see ourselves as an extra sales channel or marketing channel for the cinemas. We're not trying to compete with their websites, their apps. We're trying to get the customer who goes like twice a year to the cinema, alert them to a film that they wanted to see but just forgot to see, and I suppose just to increase sales that way.
Like, in a way, you're kind of like the Amazon for in a way, where you're kind of going, bringing all these diverse cinemas together, and you're taking a small fee for the transaction or the transactional value. And as you said, you're an extra sales guy. But I was thinking when you were saying about the cinema's job now. So I don't know if you've ever heard about Clayton Christensen's, he talks about the job of a milkshake. He said, so what do you hire a product to do? And they did this whole study on milkshakes for a fast food chain in the States. And they monitored people, what time of day they were buying the milkshake, were they on their own, were they with a family, all this kind of thing. And they realized that most milkshakes were bought before 8 a.m. on a work day. And then they asked those people who were buying the milkshakes, who were usually on the way to their car, why did they hire a milkshake? Not, that was the question they asked. Why did they hire it? And they discovered every one of those people were hiring the milkshake because they had a long drive to work. It was boring. And if they bought a more liquid product, not so viscous as a milkshake, it would be gone too quickly. And it also filled them up for a little bit longer than just a water or a banana or something like that. So when you think of the job of the cinema, like for me now, married with kids, the cinema with my wife is the time to go and turn off the phone and, you know, get away from the family unit to be with her. And the cinema experience does that job for me. And then with the family, it's to entertain and to, and so
tire the kids out.
And but it's funny because it's the same at retail in a way that they need to have much better retail experiences. If they don't, they're irrelevant. And the cinemas need to put on a better show. And I suppose you can see them going there where it's an event. It has to be an event.
Yeah.
And in that way, you're a friend. You're a friend going, here, we'll do all this for you. You focus on the event side because that's your future.
Yeah, exactly. And I think some of the cinemas we're working with in the UK, you know, their average spend per customer is up to £80 per customer, because it's not just about the meal. It's about the couple of beers or the bottle of wine that you get at your table. You're also you know, there's an after service. Some people stay around after. So it's very much changing. This is about a night out. This is about really going to enjoy yourself. And while price is important, we thought it was the only factor to get people to go to the cinema. The main reason why people are not going is they're too busy, or, you know, the weather is bad outside on a Saturday when they plan to go. So they say, let's just watch something on Netflix or Sky or whatnot. So our job is to learn and to actually help be a catalyst for someone to make a decision, be it that, you know, a great film is leaving the cinema, or there's an opening night, or there's a screening with a Q&A with the director. Most of this information, we all used to check the newspaper, which, you know, on a Friday, yeah, I used to remember just, you'd open it up.
When you had one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you'd see what's on, and then you'd make your decisions. Now we've too much stuff going on. You know, we're constantly on our phone. We just sort of zone out of certain aspects. And, you know, we did a lot of research before starting, and everyone said they love the cinema experience. We asked how often they go. They say, like, you know, every 2 months. We asked what was the last film, and it was like 12 months ago. And we asked why. They said, I don't know. There was no real reason. It was just they sort of had fallen out of love. And I suppose what we're really saying to the cinemas is, every consumer doesn't want to have a cinema app for every different cinema chain. We want one product where we put our credit card details in once. I see a film. I don't mind if it's on in Movies At or the Lighthouse or the Odeon. I say, I like this film, and just click and make a booking. Yeah. So it's really trying to put the customer first. And that's our focus. The cinema is there to make it a great experience and bring the love back for the art form of cinema.
Yeah. And how have you dealt with, so it's a network effect, essentially, where you need both sides of the unit with the demand. You need, obviously, the supply for the demand to happen. And it has to be ubiquitous. And I suppose in that respect, Ireland's a good testbed, because you can get anywhere in 3-4 hours.
Yeah.
How have you dealt with that? Because have you started with a smaller testbed within Ireland, like just Dublin or anything like that?
Yeah, so as we started first in London, and then we came back to Ireland. So we started in Dublin, and we're very much working with sort of offbeat events, quirky venues, film festivals to, I suppose, prove the model works. And we've really sort of ramped up the sales side of it. And that's to help us get into the bigger cinema chains who are probably a little bit more apprehensive to do something new. So we've just signed up, I suppose, one of the big national chains, which is going to allow us to go nationwide, hopefully in the next sort of 6 weeks, which is an exciting
Fantastic.
Moment.
Well done.
And so we're now, like, I was up in Northern Ireland last Friday. We're there up there again tomorrow. And we're hoping to see if we can sign up all the cinemas in one go. And it's great. Ireland is small.
Yeah.
And I'm doing now a road trip in the next couple of days down through sort of Waterford, Wexford, down to Cork. Stay the night somewhere down there, then going up towards sort of Dingle and Killarney. Then go up towards Clare, Galway, up to Donegal, and then back down through Derry to Dublin. So it's there's a lot of prep to get these guys on board. They're, you know, they want to see this works with someone else. So we've got great, you know, I suppose, case studies from the UK. And it's very much, you know, it's like I like to think of like the hurdles. You know, you're jumping hurdles, and each time you're going, you're getting closer to the finish line. Yeah. And it's not easy to get these guys over the line. And like, it's not easy to get a consumer to actually either download your product or to come on board, and then to get them to give you, make the first booking so you have their credit card details. And I think at that stage is when we have success, because it's very much like the halo effect. You know, why would you get a taxi on the street if you're looking to pay with a card or it's a company account? What we basically do is we have your card details. You don't have to enter them a second time.
Mm.
So it's very much, we see it as hurdles, and each step is one less hurdle.
And keep innovating them out, keep getting less and less hurdles.
Yeah.
So you're doing that road trip before, because you've another startup on the way, which is your first child as well. So
yeah,
that's going to make it. So you're trying to get this stuff done as well, I suppose. That's a burning platform that you have.
100%. Yeah. So like baby due in October. I kind of, you know, have probably 2.5 weeks mid-September, and I probably can't be, you know, stuck down the countryside. But I suppose the great thing in Ireland, if something happens, I can make it back in two or three hours.
Yeah. So you're building up that network. And then as a consumer, right, so I download the app. Is it recommended that I have push notifications on? Because is it a push system where it goes, you went to this last time, this is coming out?
It's a bit of both. So we're trying to gamify ways for you to give us more information. So we have this Tinder game in the app called Swipe Club.
Oh, nice.
On a Friday, we send a notification out saying, here's the film's out. And kind of people say, is interested, not interested.
Brilliant.
Interested, not interested.
Nice, man. And you swipe left and right.
Exactly, nice. Yeah. So what we're doing, and also we have a coming soon section where people can say films up to the next year, say, I'm interested in this film. And then when the film comes out, or it's just about to leave the cinema, we can then say, you have shown an intention to see the film, it's leaving your local cinema. And it's very, I suppose, it's really to personalize it. Like, so you don't care about a film, you know, the Odeon and Coolock, it's not, you're not going to go to it because it's too far away. So we learn which cinemas you're interested in to enable us to actually point at the right films to you in the right cinema. And I think that's the big part. This is a personal experience. Cinema is personal, as well as being very social. So everything we're doing is to try and make it easier for you to go with your wife, your friends. We make it simple to share, you know, what's on through WhatsApp. And then I suppose what's coming down the line is to allow people to book, or sorry, to pay separately for the same sort of film experience where you get to sit together.
Yeah.
So it's all about making it simpler, making it more social, and getting people out of the house.
Yeah, it's a great idea and a great product. And when you think of the data play, I mean, it's such a valuable piece of information to, like, even Tempster. Like, Tempster would have been a great supply product to go, look, these are the days you should be buying in and a little bit extra, a little bit less. This is your this is your historical data and this is your predictive data. You know, so I know it didn't competed out of the market, but now those learnings with Usher you gives you the same thing. So they able to manage their supply, staffing, all those kind of things, especially if it's becoming a more an experience event in the cinema.
Exactly. And I think, I suppose we're trying to go a step beyond it as well. So we're actually gathering reviews after people watch the films. So we're able to show both the cinemas, but also the distributors, what people think of. And we sort of break it down. Here's how your film performed with, you know, the 16 to 24 year old market. Here's how it's performed with the 25 and whatnot. And there's an awful lot of preconceptions that we've noticed already that are, you know, I suppose taboo. We've cinemas in Dalston, which would be seen as an up and coming area, but still, you know, a bit downtrodden in London. And they love documentaries. We'd never thought that. We've a big audience of older men interested in horror films. So there's...
Hey, what are you saying, man?
Well, that old. 60-year-old men.
Yeah.
And to market these, they're never marketed to because they're not interested in them.
Mm.
So what we're trying to say is we don't care if it's a man or a woman, young or old. It's all about what they like. And we can actually help distributors then reach those customers based on what they like, rather than putting an ad on television or on radio where it's expensive, but there's no metrics to show conversion.
Yeah.
So that's all we're trying to do is optimize for the two sides to, I suppose, bring more value, get more bums on seats. And I suppose everyone wins then.
But even what you said about the older cohort for the horror movies, because... Like, as the world is going the way it's going, that age group is getting bigger and bigger because there's less disease, true technology, people are living a longer. And as they call it, the grey pound or the grey euro.
Yeah.
That's a great way from cinemas. That's a good future for cinema, because if there's a special rate, which there is an OAP rate, that's a great way to actually kind of go, these are the best times to screen those. Like, so it's a great product, Ollie, and... we wish you the best luck. So it's downloadable right now.
Go to usheru.com.
Yeah.
Or you can go to the app stores and it's there.
Yeah. So it's USHERU. So usheru and usheru.com. Founder Ollie Feagan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
So now in the Innovation Show, we welcome founders of Pointy, Charles Bibby and Mark Cummins. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
Let's start from the start. Where you guys met?
Yeah, we both did our PhDs together, actually. We both did robotics in college. And, way back then, we know each other for years and years. And we sort of went our separate ways after college. I went worked at Google for a while, and I moved to Australia. And Charles, I suppose you can tell your part of the story, did something very different.
Yeah, so I went off and I was basically working in the marine electronic business and ended up doing a big security system for the London 2012 Olympics for the sailing events.
Yeah.
So lots of electronics on lots of boats. I think there's about 400 boats in total. Distributed systems, which is relevant to what we're doing now.
Brilliant. And you've a background in boats, don't you? You're interested.
I do. Yeah. I've got a sort of personal interest in boats. Yeah. So I've come from a sailing family and used to live by the sea. So I've always sort of been in and around the marine world.
And so much so that that's where you live.
I live on a boat, yeah. So I live fantastic. On a boat in Malahide, yeah.
Brilliant. And that was something you were doing in the UK as well? Or because you got in touch, you had this, the light bulb moment of Pointy.
That's right, yeah.
And you reached out to Charles while he was mid some Adriatic Sea or somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was actually down in the Balearic Islands. So I'd gone off on a 2-year sailing adventure with my fiance at the time. And I think we were actually in Ibiza when I've got Mark's first email to say that he'd got an idea for a startup and he was looking for someone to do some hardware and software. And then we got talking, didn't we?
Yeah. I mean, I emailed Charles saying, look, you know, I know you're busy. You know, I know this is never going to be for you, but you might know the right person. And then Charles sort of thought about it and turned his boat around and sailed back to Ireland.
So what did you say, Mark? What did you say at the time? What was the idea then as it was then?
Yeah, well, we was kind of interested in basically building a search engine for the contents of local shops. So like, you know, you can Google anything you want, but if you want to find what's available in the shop around the corner, you basically have to go there and check. Like if you're looking for some particular thing, like, I mean, so I used to live in Australia, I'm back here in Ireland. If I want to get like Bundaberg rum or something, like it's kind of hard to get everywhere in Australia, hard to get in Ireland. And that kind of problem, like it's sort of weird that that isn't possible. So we decided like, you know, okay, let's build a solution to that, build a way to search what's in the shops. And the first problem to solve is like most local shops aren't online. Like, you know, most shops in your neighborhood don't have a website, or if they have a website, it's very simple. It certainly doesn't list what they sell.
It's a brochure basically without the products actually.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. And so we were kind of thinking, how are we going to get like the catalog of all these shops online so that we can sort of make this search engine and like, you know, bring these shops into the kind of internet world. And so the solution we came up with is called what we call the Pointy Box. It's a little like hardware device that the shops plugs into their barcode scanner, and it's basically like a mobile phone, you know, kind of, and it sort of connects to the barcode scanner. And when they scan something with the scanner, it just goes straight up onto their website. So we basically make their barcode scanner like connect to their website, and so that makes it really, really easy for the shops and like all sorts of shops who'd never have like any sort of, you know, technology, or they wouldn't have a website or anything. They can just plug this in, and in like 5 minutes, they have, you know, a full website that's like live updated and all their stock is maintained, and we figure out all the names and the pictures from them and all that kind of thing.
That's brilliant.
So, that's Pointy.
So before we come back to Pointy in a second, but Mark told you about this idea. You were kind of tuned out, and you were tuned into your holiday and into your fiance now wife. So it obviously you were very tuned in.
So sort of, you know, I was floating around with a notebook, you know, coming up with ideas, my own ideas really for a startup, and Mark's idea was way better than anything that I'd come up with. It was a problem that like really resonated with me, because I was spending a lot of time traveling around foreign cities looking for things. And sometimes, you know, to find a book in Spain might take me 2 days of traipsing around asking questions. So this was something that I could really do with, you know, there and then.
Yeah.
And just thought it was a brilliant idea and desperate to get involved.
Providence as well, that you were challenged with that exact problem.
Yeah.
And because you started working on it straight away, like on the side of the ocean.
So the first prototype Pointy Box was actually built at anchor off of Ibiza Island. And the problem was I'd set off on this trip with no intention of doing any development work. So I didn't have any equipment with me. So I managed to get my fiance's dad to fly out for a holiday, basically, with a suitcase full of oscilloscopes and power supplies and soldering irons and all the things you need to do electronics. And the first Pointy Box was soldered up at anchor off of Ibiza.
That's good.
Which was just to make sure that it would actually, you know, work.
You could do it.
Before sailing, you know, thousands of miles back to Ireland. Yeah.
So I love that, because we talk so much about MVPs and, you know, get it out there, build something, ship something. Before you actually go and create it, and you did that, and like talk about like it reminds me of like a Google-esque hackathon, Mark, right. Where it's like, let's hack this together now.
Yeah,
and I can just imagine you sitting there in the sunset, and your wife going, "Come on, we're going for dinner." And you're going, "I already have this."
Yeah, it's very much like that. Yeah, exactly like that, with a generator running as well to run the oscilloscope. Yeah.
So then let's come back to what you were saying, Mark, because I love. Because when I first read about you guys, and we met about 2.5 years ago, must be at this stage, or 2 years, it was the fact that, A, the problem, not for just the consumer, not for us trying to find products or an inventory of products, was the companies don't have a mindset of how to put a website together, the time to do so, et cetera, et cetera. And it not only solves that we'll get you online as soon as possible. It's like, we'll do it as you're scanning the stuff anyway.
Yeah.
That's what I thought was beautiful about the product. Cause it's like, there's no excuse to do this. Like, they literally have no excuse but to use the product.
Yeah. We try and like, you know, our whole philosophy is about like remove work for them, like remove every friction. And, you know, even when we made design choices in the product, we were thinking like, you know, if there's an A or B, let's do the alternative that's like the least possible work for the shop, even to the extent of like, you know, removing choices, a bit like Apple-esque, where you kind of like say, okay, let's just like
one button,
yeah, you know, make it really simple.
Yeah.
And it seems to kind of like be, you know, it seems to work basically. You know, the retailers like it, you know, there's very little to go wrong. You know, they just plug it in, it does its job, and it just sort of sits there a bit like a fridge or a fan or something, you know, it's just, it's
brilliant.
It can't really break, and it just connects up to their website, and then, you know, keeps their website up to date.
Yeah. So it's not only the only part of the pie, because obviously then you have to build a platform for the shops to sit upon. And I suppose the analogy I can think of that might resonate with the audience is it's like a Facebook for shops.
Yeah.
So you basically have a page, a profile, and under which you have your location, which is, I'm sure, unbelievably SEO friendly, Google friendly, Mark, with your background, but also then with your inventory of stock on that page.
Mm-hmm.
And like, so when I think about Airbnb and you thought about their original challenges, it was one of them was like the apartment owner is putting up really crappy images of their apartment, and that's making the platform look not so desirable. But you dealt with that nicely, because I've seen some of the imagery, and the imagery is nice because it's almost drawing from stock that's there, if the top quality picture of stock that's there.
Yeah, I mean, one of the big problems for a store, if they want to put together a website, is they have to source the product data. So like, even if they know exactly what they stock, they've got like a file of their barcodes, they have to go and get the product image and the product name. And that's a lot of work. So we centralize all that. We have a team of, well, we have an automated system, then a team of people who like make sure all those images are really good. And that just takes out a lot of the problems that the store would have doing it themselves. So we talked to some stores, and like the stores who are a bit more sophisticated, who are already doing this, they might be spending, you know, 10 or 15 hours a week on it. And for, you know, a big store might have 20,000 products, and new products come in, old products go out, you know, the images change and stuff. And so, you know, we just basically take all that off their hands, and we do it for almost nothing, basically, because we centralize it. And so it's very cheap for them.
Yeah. And then, I mean, so once you have that, like, this is not, it's not over yet. So first, then the next thing you have is the network effect. So you have to get clusters of shops in like at scale for the product. So it's like the telephone, the more people that have a telephone, the better it is for a telephone user.
Yeah.
Same appointee, because if you want people to engage with the platform, they need to be able to find a shop around their corner. So how did you deal with that challenge getting started with building a network locally?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely critical, right? Because, I mean, we've got the pointy app, and like you can pull it out and search for things, and you want to see your neighborhood stores come up, right? And so, you know, if we have 500 stores scattered around the world, I mean, that's no use.
Yeah.
But like, you know, the way we started out, we were like, let's just focus on you know, one country in Ireland, and like even to begin with just one city, Dublin, and let's get real density in this area. So you've got this sort of local network effect going on. And that works for the user's point of view. And it also kind of works for the sales point of view. When you've got the stores, you can say, well, hey, look, the store down the street is on, or there's five shops in BlackRock that are using this now. And that sort of, that helps it get started. And, you know, then you can kind of have these case studies where you can go to the next city and say, well, look, you know, one in 10 of every shop in Dublin's, you know, picked this up. And so like, maybe it's going to work pretty well in Cork as well, and so on. Yeah.
And how did you, like, I mean, how did you, so it was the two of you. So essentially you guys were the sales team at the start.
The very, very start. Yes. Although we pretty quickly got a dedicated salesperson.
Yeah. So what was your first sale then?
The first sale was me. I walked into Donnybrook Bikes, which is my local bike shop.
Yeah. And I asked them. I'm a user.
Yeah. So I asked them, you know, hey, do you want to do this? And they said, yeah. So it's very interesting, like, you know, just how simple it can be.
Yeah. And also, I suppose the benefit from that is you're not only getting to meet the client, the end client, but you're one of the end clients, I suppose, from the client side, from the shop side, but you're finding out real time data and what's their challenges, what's their obstacles, rather than sending somebody out who's reporting it back to you.
Or selling. I mean, we sell online as well. People come and sign up via our website, but like there's this huge communication gap when someone signs up via your website. Like, you know, when you go in and talk to someone and like have a chat with them, you often learn a lot more quickly. And so we definitely spend a lot of time just walking around, walking into shops, talking to people. And that's it's very, very useful.
To try and remove any kind of friction, I suppose, or mental obstacles that they might have from using the product.
Yeah, exactly. And figure out what their real problems are, and, you know, are we working on the right things for them?
So what?
And we go back and chat with them, you know, from time to time still, don't we?
Yeah.
To go back and see how's it going.
How they're experiencing the service.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's where we can improve, you know?
Yeah, because if you think of your site, it's a SaaS product essentially as well.
Right.
So your site's part of your sales team. It's doing a lot of work for you as well. Yeah. And therefore, that needs to be a really clear message. And how would you define that message on a site versus in person, I suppose?
So on the site, I think we say, you know, plug in this box and basically it's going to, you know, list everything online and bring more people in the door. So that's the key message we give to them, is like, bring more people through your door. You know, for a lot of websites, or a lot of shops, you know, if you're a local, you know, convenience store or something, the idea of having a website isn't immediately, they're like, oh, why do I need that? But when you say like, okay, it's going to bring people in the door, you say like, you make the extra step that people are going to find you and then they come in. You know, that's what a lot of these stores want. They don't want to have an e-commerce website, right? But they do want to have, you know, be found and have foot traffic. Yeah. And so it's kind of like an advertising, you know, system to have a website in a way.
Because it's one of these things that is a problem, you know, it's a problem, but you kind of tolerate, and you guys didn't tolerate it. You went, we're going to do something about it. But when you think of where it could go, I mean, the data that you could see, the clusters of data of X product sells better than this stuff. And you could actually sell that bit data back to the FMCG companies and kind of go, you know, Kerrygold sells really well in D6, or, you know, and you can actually start telling different clusters of data. And then also your collection of imagery as well, because you're creating essentially an inventory of stock images that can be used. And are they open source, or how does that work, those images, when they're...
That's an enormous amount, like probably spent a year of our engineering time to put that together. And so we pull it from all these different sources, and then like some of those are licensed in different ways and stuff. Yeah. So unfortunately we can't like just sort of
disseminate it afterwards.
You know, at least then we can have a good service that we can give to the people on the platform.
But, and that tied into a bit of your expertise in Google, didn't it, Mark?
Right, yeah. So at Google, I used to work on sort of machine learning and computer vision. So like recognizing images and saying, you know, this image is a cat and this image is a dog, that kind of thing was what I worked on.
And context around that as well, as much as possible.
Yeah, I mean, everything to do with basically understanding images and you know, like understanding, you know, like sensory data.
Yeah, because didn't you work on glass?
Google early goggles,
goggles.
The product I was on. Yeah, so a lot of Google's internal. So it's actually my second startup. So my first company we sold to Google in 2010 became part of their computer vision system.
And then that's how you went into Google.
That's right.
Oh, brilliant. Okay. And what was that product?
Well, it was sort of like a forerunner to Google Goggles. So if people have seen it, it's like Google's system where you can like point your phone at a painting and it tells you who painted it.
Brilliant.
Or it's involved in Google Photos now. For example, you can sort of type in, you know, waterfall and find all your holiday photos in front of a waterfall without having tagged them. You know, so it understands the contents. So
that's brilliant. And you can search by image now as well. Can you drag it?
Search
can
drag by image is, yeah. I mean, there was like a big team at Google worked on various different products. They're all kind of closely interrelated. Yeah. So, Google Translate was something I spent a lot of time on as well, where you can point at text in a foreign language and it renders it into your language. Wow. So that was something I spent a lot of time on. It's great to see people using that.
Yeah. And it's great. It's great that, I mean, these things kind of force you to think differently as well. Mm. So what's next? What can we see coming out next? And I know you're building that network effect essentially, and you started with the test bed and you're spreading that as much as possible across the country. But what else can we expect to see coming down the line? I know the app came out not too long ago.
Yeah, the app's out recently. Anyone listening, definitely give it a go.
Yeah.
We're expanding the shop footprint a lot. Now we're starting in, we've recently started in New York. So
brilliant.
We're trying the US market now as well. And the product is just like, you know, always more and more polished, which is great. Like, you know, there's so much, when you start out, you can write down a list of the things you're interested in. And it's very easy in 5 minutes to write down a list. It'll take you 3 or 4 years to actually build it all, because there's so much in doing every single thing.
Yeah.
So now we're finally getting to the point where I feel like, okay, all right, we're really starting to tick things off the list. Like, you know, we thought, like you mentioned there a little while ago, giving people insights back into their own data. So we can now tell a shop, like, these are the things that people are looking for online. So maybe you should start, you know, maybe putting them front and center in your store, that kind of thing. So it's really nice to see those things starting to mature.
Or even, when you say that, like, when is the best time to advertise, you know, a certain product or a certain sale, or you can tell seasonality and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So Mark, you mentioned that you're able to refine the product time and time again much quicker now than you used to. So I know Michael Gill's part of the team, and he's kind enough to arrange the meeting twice. who else is on the team? How many other people have you got?
Seven of us all together.
Yeah.
And there was four of us in engineering, and then three in sort of sales and operations and support and marketing and everything else.
Brilliant.
So we're a small team, but it's amazing how much you can get done with a small set of people who are kind of totally focused on one thing.
Yeah, it makes all the difference. And is there, how can people get in touch?
Pointy.com. If you want to sign up as a retailer, go there or download the app and give it a try. It's, yeah, definitely have a look. It's we've had an awful lot of people try it now. It's about 200,000 people have you know, found something through Pointy since launch. So maybe coming up on, I'd say maybe about 1 in 10 of everyone in Dublin has been on Pointy at some stage.
Brilliant.
So,
heading towards 1,000 people a day, you find something, isn't it? Which is great.
About 1,000 people.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. It's, and people are looking for everything from, you know, we see a lot of craft beer, a lot of health foods, cosmetics. Like when it's raining, you see people search for umbrellas sometimes. You know, it's kind of all sorts of stuff. So it's really great to see it getting out there and getting used.
But Charles Bibby and Mark Cummins, founders of Pointy, thanks for coming in to us.
Thank you very much.